You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Well, time for us to talk politics. Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com, joining us for a look back at the weekend politics. And Jim, let's start with the Senate debate on TV Tuesday night. Give us your analysis of what's going on with the race to fill the Senate seat from the late Dianne Feinstein.
Well, there was a new poll came out from Emerson College, an independent poll that indicated that Steve Garvey had moved into a pretty solid second place. Every piece of data has Adam Schiff in first, and the big battle is for second place. And it's really amusing now because you've got Schiff running ads to help Garvey get in second place, and now Katie Porter spending money to help one of the other Republicans to try to take some votes away from Garvey. So it's really kind of a scream because there's not enough Republican money around to even do many of the ads. And so the Democrats are actually paying for ads for to attack the Republicans as being too conservative, you know. And it's pretty amusing, but it does look like Schiff was only up 28-22 over Garvey in this latest poll, and then Katie Porter was way down at 16, which is the biggest gap that there has been between second and third on any of the data I've seen. So that as we get closer to March 5th, that's not a bad sign for Garvey. It's sort of a no win for Republicans. I mean, if Garvey were to make second place, it would eliminate Porter. That would probably be the best thing for Republicans. But as we all know, a Republican's not going to win the general election, regardless of who it is.
Here is Garvey talking about some of the things that, you know, he can point to that take place not under his watch, but under those before him and the current Democrat administration. Take a listen.
Well, these career politicians, 3 years ago, they were on the watch that has created what it is today. When the president took office, he signed 90 different bills. And what he did was he turned off gas and oil. And when that happens, energy goes through the roof. It affects all elements of our life. But what really happened is the overspending in Washington, which caused inflation.
Well, it's got some points there, doesn't he?
It certainly does. No question about that.
Yeah, the Democrats, though, the others are tied to this administration and have to dance carefully as they talk about problems. They love to point fingers, but, it isn't exactly the same as being able to be independent, saying you're not tied to it. Let's take a listen. Here is Katie Porter, who spent much of the debate going after Congressman Adam Schiff, who leads in most polls.
Look, I'm different than Representative Schiff. He's taken corporate PAC checks from BP, from Sempra, from SoCalGas, and these are household names. They are polluters. So people can count on me to do Washington differently.
And then Schiff responded to the criticisms.
I don't think Representative Porter has been fully clear about her own record of taking thousands of dollars from people in the oil industry, thousands from Wall Street bankers, thousands from people in pharma industry, as Open Secrets has revealed.
And then you have Congresswoman Barbara Lee says she's the right candidate to protect California and the rest of the nation from the impacts of climate change.
Climate justice is extremely important. And in the Senate, I would fight to make sure we pass the Green New Deal, which includes a just transition for our workers from a fossil fuel economy to a green economy.
Now, I want to get your reaction, but as I watch this, the answer on the part of the Democrats always involves suing the oil companies somehow to get revenue to make up budget shortfalls or to help in transitions. I mean, I'm sorry, but we do need fossil fuel, and we're not ready to give it up, are we?
Oh, of course not. It's ridiculous. But that's I wouldn't put it past them. I mean, look what happened with the decision against Trump in New York with and all of these civil cases they filed against him. They're just trying to bankrupt him, and they're going to try to do the same thing to the oil companies and put them out of business. It's just absurd what's going on. And listening to that, these that provide these services and resources were some, you know, gangsters or something that, oh, you took money from corporations. You know, how horrible that is. And that's how far things have gotten out of control. And it's really, really very, very dangerous. They're going to win the seat. And the problem is you keep getting more and more of these people elected. We're going to see more and more of this type of behavior continue.
I like to watch them squirm when they were asked about nuclear energy. It's kind of a difficult thing for them to to do. They have to acknowledge that we kind of need it, but we need to shut it down. I mean, they have to kind of dance, don't they?
Oh, they sure do. They sure do. Because, you know, the wind and the sun is never going to be enough to provide all the energy that people need. And, you know, this is just such a dangerous and really idiotic path that they are on in regards to what keeps the economy moving. And that's, of course, the energy industry.
All right, over to the Biden administration. You can always tell it's election season because this is when the promised handouts start to get offered, and the Biden administration announcing over $1 billion of student loan debt forgiveness. Have we heard that before? Well, yes, we have. In fact, the last time he tried to do this, the Supreme Court shut him down, told him you don't get to do that, that the Congress has the power of the purse. But that doesn't stop him. He does it anyway. It's election season. He hopes the younger voters will see this, and even though he can't really fulfill it because it gets stopped, he does it anyway. Is this par for the course for, campaign season for Democrats?
Well, if we look at what Biden's doing here, that's a good example of the student loan. Is now all of a sudden in tough on the border, on and on with what he's doing on policy and his latest statements. That confirms that the internal Biden polling is showing what we're seeing on the national level in the public polling, that he's losing. And in fact, the Decision Desk HQ came out with their cumulative ratings of all the polling, and they show Trump with the highest number of electoral votes he's ever had, with all the swing states right now going his way. And I think Biden's actions and his positions on these latest issues, as you pointed out, on student loan, on the border now, and all this other things that Biden's talking about, confirms that he's in real trouble for re-election. And by the way, he will be the Democratic nominee on March 19th. He will have enough delegates after all the primaries are concluded on March 19th to become the Democratic nominee. So this is what's going to happen for the rest of the year. And this idea that people on the Democratic side are just going to move him out of the way, it's just not going to happen. He's going to be the nominee.
Right. Over to the Republican side, of course, this weekend, South Carolina Republican primary, Nikki Haley staying in no matter what, making that perfectly clear this week.
Nikki Haley is the last major Republican candidate running against Donald Trump in the 2024 presidential election, and she says she's not backing down. Haley has yet to win a GOP contest this election cycle, but she's vowed to stay in the running until Super Tuesday on March 5th. In an interview with the AP, Haley says that not enough people have voted in the election for her to back down yet.
Why would I do that when only at that point four states have voted? 10 days after South Carolina, another 20 states vote. I mean, this isn't Russia.
She gets up there, and boy, can she parse words. She likes to deliver this talking point where she says, you know, in the first two elections, 40-something percent rejected Donald Trump. And the next thing I'm thinking, well, would you like to tell us what number rejected you? And she doesn't tell us that, does she?
No, she certainly doesn't, and it's really kind of stunning what she's doing. I'm not sure why she's doing what she's doing, because it's clearly obvious as her home state has rejected her. What's going through her mind? I'm not sure, because obviously she's not somebody that's going to go away, and she's going to be back in 2028. And I'm not sure that why she thinks what she's doing right now helps her in the future. And I don't think it does. And it's really, I just think, very, very strange what she's doing. And I don't think she's helping herself at all. No. And she's not hurting Trump.
No. But if she had, and she even in a speech earlier in the week addressed these things that we're thinking, like, you know, are you angling for the next time around? Are you trying to get more name notoriety? What's the plan here? Because at a certain point, if you don't get with the program, you seem like an outsider. You know, I think a perennial candidate, somebody who runs longer than they should, is somebody like a Kasich. You remember years ago, I think it was 2016, he just kind of stays in, and, you know, he shows up, and you kind of include him, but you know he doesn't have a chance, but he does it anyway. Is this the same kind of thing, or is she kind of trying to be the insurance policy, thinking that if if Trump somehow or another gets tossed in jail because of one of these cases, well, she's the go-to person.
That is the only thing that may make some sense to explain why she's in this when it's obvious what's going to be happening here. And, you know, when you get people like that in your home state, I just can't see how she thinks that helps her or makes her stronger in the rest of the country. And so it's really kind of hard to explain.
All right. After South Carolina this weekend, you've got Super Tuesday coming up, a bunch of states there. You're expecting low turnout in California. They say that the number of absentee ballots has not been exciting coming back. Is that probably the case?
Oh, that's probably the case, yes. And we have the Michigan primary on Tuesday. So for both primaries, and that's a big one. And Trump's way up in that one, too. And but it doesn't surprise me at all that the early vote's off because, you know, nobody's excited about coming out to vote for Biden. And I think that's reflective in the state like California, which should be extremely strong for him, and that the turnout would be low. And that's not a surprise at all, and another indication that the Biden campaign is in trouble.
What about these congressional seats in California and how tight things are? Have you been looking ahead at the election in November? You've got about 30 seconds here.
Very much so. California is going to be one of the key states, and New York actually is the other, that very likely determines the outcome of the House majority. And 52 congressional races in California, and you've got 19 seats where there's competition, either one way or another, either with seven open seats. The jungle primary on March the 5th is going to tell us a lot as to what's happening there. And we'll have the general election really beginning starting March 6th. And those races are going to be critical. And the Republicans, remember, they overperformed the redistricting map in 2022 by four seats. And it's going to be a real challenge to keep all of those.
Yeah,
and if they can, maybe they can hold the majority.
Right, but New York didn't go well in filling Santos' seat. Out of time, Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. We'll talk with you next week.
Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Baseball legend Steve Garvey joining us right now. If you haven't heard, he is running for U.S. Senate for the open seat in California. And he is with us now. Steve Garvey, good to talk with you again.
As always, Larry, thank you so much.
Well, let's see. This week you had a third and final debate, I think it was, with the three others who were running for the Senate seat. And you got up there and kind of were the counter voice to the others. What was it like to be up there and give answers that actually common sense? Let's just listen to one of them that you addressed. They talked about the budget deficit. They talked about inflation. And you just quietly said this.
Well, these career politicians, 3 years ago, they were on the watch that has created what it is today. When the president took office, he signed 90 different bills. And what he did was he turned off gas and oil. And when that happens, energy goes through the roof. It affects all elements of our life. But what really happened is the overspending in Washington, which caused inflation.
But you're up against a group that doesn't see that at all. What do you think when you're sitting there hearing their answers?
You know, I remember the movie, The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight. it was a funny cowboy movie, and that's how I felt up there. You know, and it was three debates. The first one was the first time I had debated in 60 years. I think I was running for junior class president at Chamberlain High in Tampa, Florida. And it was with an audience. So I was, you know, trying to get my footing and grounding on that. I think I held my own. Somebody said, you did better in the first game of the Senate playoffs than they would have done the first game of the NLCS at Dodger Stadium. So I thought that was a compliment. But it was, it's really myself against these three progressives. They try to tap dance and say they are, and especially Katie Porter and Adam Schiff. But, you know, my campaign has been grounded on common sense and compassion and consensus. And really grounded on faith, but it's almost redundant with each one of the debates. They're all a little different. You know, the last two have been on stage. The second one at K-Ron up in San Francisco and last night at KNBC. The moderators are different, but similar. I thought the last two, The second one was seamless. They were very quick, tight. Last night, the moderators were good, but they set up their questions longer, which I think once we realized what the question was, it gave us time to think. But it gave my opponents time to tap dance. And that's why, you know, we've done tens of hours of debate prep so that I could deliver a clear, concise message to the people of California.
Not to interrupt, but it was like you're talking directly to California. They're talking to the debate. It's almost as if you took an aside in your answers and said, well, look, you know, this is what we need to do, and this is what we have, you know, kind of the common sense. Let's listen to, here's Adam Schiff talking about bringing down costs. Take a listen to this.
But more than that, we need to bring down energy costs. We can do this with a windfall profits tax on oil companies.
I'm thinking, what? Okay, you're going to bring down energy costs by taxing the oil companies. Your eyes started to roll, right? What were your thoughts?
Absolutely. Well, you know, this is America. I believe in free market capitalism, supply and demand. Our oil companies, and like I said towards the end of the debate last night, this is the fundamental energy of America is oil and gas. We're looking for new ways of energy, clean energy, nuclear, wind, water. But when it comes down to what the people want is they want to keep what they're friendly with and cost the least until you shut off that oil and gas like the president back 3 years ago, which drove prices sky high across the board, transportation, daily living. So what I wanted to do is make sure that the people knew that I'm running for all the people. I'm not running for half the people. They're only running for half the people. And that's the people that they vote, their party votes. They vote 97-98% of the time down party line. I consciously could never do that because when I look at a bill that's coming up, I'll look at it is this going to help my neighbors and friends and the people of California first and then the country second? And if it doesn't, I won't vote for it, you know, regardless of the party. So I think that, you know, like I said last night, I'm a new face, kind of, but who's going to have new ideas. And when it's all said and done after 6 years, I will have hoped that when people talk about who they would like to emulate in the Senate, they will say Steve Garvey was the man of the people. He is the one who every day got up and swung for the fence so that the people's quality of life was the most important thing in his life.
Well, you didn't let them draw you into anything. Listen to Schiff talk about the wealthy paying their fair share and the nod they're trying to give you being a wealthy ball player. You let it blow right by. You didn't engage or ask for some time. Take a listen to what he does here. This is his idea of how to fix budgets and everything else.
Now, the deficit is a real problem, and I think a big part of the reason why it's a problem is that the wealthy and corporations are not paying their fair share.
Whoa! Not anybody who does the math, right? Like the top 1% pay the most of all this stuff.
And by the way, we've lost over 1 million people in California over the last 3 to 4 years. And those people were hardworking people basically from the middle class, who may have wanted to start small businesses, which is the foundation of our economy in California's country, but couldn't do it. So they left. I mean, when I traveled to Nashville, people have come up to me, they're couples. Oh, it's great to see a Californian, Steve. How are you doing? We heard you're running. Oh, gosh, wish we were back. But we couldn't afford it. They said, we miss it. You know, we love California. We couldn't afford it. How could we have driven this many people out of California that were going to pay taxes? But now there's only two classes. It's the wealthy and the welfare. I mean, when you see that Californians are paying welfare for illegal immigrants, it gets back to common sense. You scratch your head. Wait a minute.
We're paying health care is what we're paying for them now, too.
I mean, it's a socialist environment. Let's just face it. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Back to Schiff and his comments. He suggests the housing crisis. Oh, just build more housing. No idea of CEQA, of the costs of building, of union labor. The materials cost more. You can't sell something for less than it costs to build, and they restrict building so much. People would love to have built more here, but they're squeezed out by regulation, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I was ready with CEQA last night. I couldn't get to it. That's the problem with the debate. You know,
oh, I know. You get your 1 minute and they thank you and they shut you down and it's on to the next topic. It's like, whoa, we got a great topic here. Let's stay on it. You know, Adam Schiff, you really think that building more houses is just snap your fingers and are going to be built? There's a reason they're not being built now. Let's talk about it and let's see what we can do to fix it. They didn't stop long enough to do that. It's almost like they have to cram so much into the 1 hour, it really makes it tough.
Right. And by the way, 1 hour is much better than 90 minutes. 90 minutes starts to drag and things unravel. And in the first debate, which was good for me, they started going after each other. And
that's always good.
That's because they're all in the same pool, so to speak, and they're all going to fight it out. And I just kind of stood back and watched them, you know, and but when you don't have a lot of time, that's why I hope to, God willing, we'll get through this primary. It looks great. To do more town halls with an audience and a moderator and sit there and have questions from the people and talk to the people. Instead of being on a stage like that and having the three of them, you know, go far left and I'm trying to get my message through. And thank the Lord, I think I have. Yeah. This last poll had me at 22%, I think Schiff at 26, 28, Porter at 16. But where I've
you're
come
up there,
from,
yeah. And let's take the headlines real quick. New York Times, riding his baseball fame, Steve Garvey disrupts the California Senate race. That's one. Register, Schiff Garvey lead in U.S. Senate race with Porter now a third, poll shows. Mercury News, Steve Garvey rocks into second behind Adam Schiff. Now let's talk just a second because you know how we get in talk radio and politics. We start to analyze and go, okay, Schiff has bought a lot of ads talking about you, saying you're too conservative. You're coming up because of some of that exposure. He wants to run against you because it's easier to knock you out in the general than Porter. You've heard all that. What do you say?
Well, be careful what you ask for. And, you know, I've got 50 years of wonderful currency with the people of California, and they know me. They trust me. They know that I cared about them. And last night, Telemundo was part of the broadcast, and I made sure I thanked the Latino people for tuning in because I wanted to talk to them about their lives, about the tremendous influx at the border now in San Diego. That's going to become a serious problem in California and affect their lives. I mean, these are people, are Latino families who have come the right way, are hardworking. They pay their taxes. They just want to go out to eat once a week. And they want their kids to play sports, and they want to be able to pay for that. They want to be able to pay for their education. But that's where the illegal immigrants are going to target. So I wanted them to know that back in Washington, they will be job one for me, along with, of course, the rest of the people. But these are the people that will be attacked by the illegal immigrants in their communities for their jobs specifically. Yeah.
I heard one benefit. They don't want, the writers don't want to acknowledge you as having the potential to win, but they will give you this. They say if Garvey runs, that will help the congressional races down ticket because as Republicans and independents go to vote, they can also check off the Republican members of Congress. So they're giving you that much, but they won't give you the fact that you could actually win. And you say back to them, watch out.
Don't take kindness or weakness. Don't, you're really disrespecting the people who are all around in the state and in the country have come up to me and said, Steve, thanks so much for running. Bless you. We know it's tough, but you've stood up and maybe we should stand up. That too, and support you and get this one party state back to where there's two voices. Yours is the loudest now. There are people who have been told good men and women who should run for office. There's no way they can win. So they step away. But I'm getting a lot of them talking to me now in our campaign about how we're running this campaign, how far we've come in a short amount of time. And if I do anything, if I get people to stand up and be this common sense, compassionate voice to build consensus, then I will have hit a home run. But we're going for the grand slam, Larry.
There you go. Going for the grand slam, even if you've hit a home run. Thank you so much. By the way, I love the sports analogies, and I know there's a real connection to the sports world with you all your years. I remember watching you play baseball, being, you know, in Dodger Stadium as a kid, seeing you. I mean,
that's the time.
A lot of fun. Hey, appreciate it. Steve Garvey. Take care.
Thanks, Larry. Let's keep it going.
Back with more Politics and Issues next.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Congressman Jay Obernolte represents the 23rd Congressional District, and he is with us to talk about some of the stories in the news. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be here. I always enjoy our conversations.
A lot to talk about. Let's first begin on your work as chairman of a task force that you are involved with. Take us into what you're working on these days, what you're going to be working on.
Sure. Well, Speaker Mike Johnson has just announced the creation of a House task force on artificial intelligence, and I'm very honored to have been named the chairman of that task force. So we have 24 members of Congress who will, on a bipartisan basis, spend the next year working through both the benefits and the risks of artificial intelligence to our society, and hopefully crafting an appropriate federal regulatory framework for the rules governing the use of AI. That's something that, as you're aware, Congress is a little bit behind in getting to. So I am very honored that the Speaker has entrusted us with that responsibility, and really excited to get started.
Yeah, it has a lot of pluses, but there are concerns that it's going to take all our jobs.
Absolutely, yes.
I was looking. There's actually a new news network that is 100% AI, and they don't use human beings. They can type their scripts in and have these AI newscasters do the news. Not a good idea. Don't like it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the biggest problems with AI is the fact that it has a tendency to what we call hallucinate, which means if you ask it a question that it doesn't have a ready answer to, quite often it will make up an answer.
Yes.
So but that should get everyone who might rely on it for news some pause.
There you go. In fact, just a real quick side story. I asked AI to generate a story about me, and it began okay, but then it got me conflated with somebody else and said I had written articles for a metallurgy magazine. I'm thinking, what? You know, thank you.
There you go. That's so, a perfect illustration of the problem, isn't it?
Doesn't know right from wrong. It just spits it out one after another. All right, so you're going to be working on that. Let's jump to some of the stories that are in the news right now. Some of the things, obviously, the border with Mexico, the plan that didn't get voted on, money for Ukraine. I mean, there's a lot to talk about here. Start to unpack it.
Sure. Well, I'm sure that everyone is following this crisis at our southern border. It has grown to epic proportions. The Customs and Border Patrol had over 300,000 migrant encounters in the month of December. To put it in context, that is the most in the history of our country. Our communities are completely overwhelmed with immigrants. They're trying to provide social services to prevent the complete breakdown of society's rules in those communities. It's costing money that no one has. And even districts like the one that I represent, which doesn't have an international border, have become border communities in essence, because not only are these migrants flowing into our communities, but also the fentanyl and other drugs that are being trafficked across our border are flowing into these communities. In San Bernardino County, which is the majority of the district that I represent, we've experienced an over 600% increase in fentanyl-related deaths. It is the number one cause of death nationwide for young people between the ages of 18 and 40 right now. I mean, exceeding even traffic accidents, fentanyl poisoning. So, you know, this is a problem that absolutely desperately needs to be taken care of. And I'll tell you from firsthand experience, I've been to the border several times in the last couple of years. If you haven't seen it yourself, I can tell you from experience, the problem is worse than what you've seen. It is dire.
Yeah, and for a while you had the Biden administration denying that there was anything wrong, that they would say the border is secure. Of course, Mayorkas, he's being impeached, so there is something to that, but yet, you know, it just it doesn't get solved. And it just is. I think it's happening on purpose, that maybe Democrats want to have more potential Democrats down the line, and they're remaking the electorate somehow. That's my opinion on it. Let me ask you this. What do those who come into this country illegally do during the day? Because I hope they're not burglarizing us. I mean, do they get to make a living? Do they get work cards or anything?
Well, they don't currently, but everyone knows that our employment system and the rules governing the hiring of illegal immigrants is very loosely and sporadically enforced. So it's kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know, these people are going to be in the parking lot of your Home Depot looking to go lay tile. And you know, let me be clear about one thing. We're a nation based on immigration. Immigrants have made many positive contributions here, and I believe that most people who are coming here are doing so not because they have a nefarious intention, but because they want to work and improve their own lives and the lives of their family. But we're a nation based on the rule of law. We cannot allow people who aren't following the rules to come over here and displace the people that are following the rules. That's just inconsistent.
Well, and we also hear that there are the getaways, the ones who are coming into this country, and those who are coming from some of the countries that aren't exactly on our, you know, friends list right now. And there's questions.
Oh, absolutely.
Right?
And let's be clear. You know, Secretary Mayorkas testified before Congress a few weeks ago that 85% of the immigrants that CBP detains are released into the United States. So we're not even talking about getaways here. We're talking about people that CBP has detained and then released here. I mean, it's just completely unconscionable what's going on. And you know what? Here's the tragedy of it. I was talking to the CBP the other day. They told me that they think that the one action that the federal government is already empowered to take could reduce the number of migrants crossing the border by about 70%. And that is just reinstituting the policy of remain in Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
That policy is one that was enforced under the Trump administration, and it says very simply that if you want asylum in the United States, you have to apply from where you are, and that if you cross the border illegally before your asylum application is processed, you're no longer eligible for asylum.
Right, but they're not.
That is just basic common sense.
But the Biden administration doesn't want that. They have all these people here. There's lots of things that you wonder with this. I wonder, we're here in California. California politicians and those in the legislature and the governor have signed off and are giving health care benefits to those here illegally. And there's some people who are here legally not getting them. I mean, we have a real question there. Is that not a magnet? If we're going to offer health care to people coming into this country, that's just basically saying, come on in. We don't have any rules, and we're going to give you something paid for by those who are here legally for you. What's that?
Yeah, you are so right about that. This is the basic problem that we have, is that the incentive structure that exists incentivizes people to cross the border illegally. And there's nothing that can be done to reduce that flow that's going to be effective until we change the incentives for misbehavior. You know, and that's one of the things that I really disagree with the Biden administration. Thinking and acting as if the problem can be solved by just beefing up CBP enforcement. You know, there's nothing we can do without changing those incentives.
Well,
and, you know, talking about health care, you know, think about the fact that the state of California just declared a $60 billion budget deficit. You know, how on earth are they justifying expanding Medi-Cal to the coverage of illegal immigrants when that kind of budget deficit exists?
They'll look at a wealth tax or some other way to raise revenue, and they just say the wealthy aren't paying their fair share. Meanwhile, people are getting up and leaving. You know, your district could lose people, and more districts, they're saying four congressional districts may be gone in 10 years, right?
Yeah, it could be. And you know what? I think it's humorous that the progressive left always claims that the wealthy aren't paying their share. Let me tell you a statistic that I ran across just the other day. Just basic math. If the left got their way and we increased taxation of the wealthy, anyone making over $500,000 a year, we increased the tax rate to 100%. So basically the government confiscated every penny of income over $500,000. It would still not be enough to balance the current federal budget deficit.
Course.
Think about that. That belies, you know, this misinformation that it's the wealthy not paying their share. No, we are spending too much.
But we need
That's
more stories like yours to counter that aren't getting out there by Republicans, because it's, you know, the Democrats say it over and over again, and, you know, I think some people unfortunately believe it. All right, so we have the border.
Yep.
You're working on some veterans issues. Quickly, we have just a couple minutes left. What are you working on in the area of veterans issues?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I am very honored to represent five different major military installations. And so I am really interested in making sure that our veterans get the care and benefits that they earned and that they've deserved through their service to our country. That's something that has been a hallmark of my values for the last 10 years. And so I've been working with Chairman Mike Bost, who's chair of the Veterans Committee, on some really meaningful legislation. Last year, we were able to pass something called the PACT Act, which finally grants benefits and a service-related connection to all of our veterans that are coming home from places like Afghanistan and Iraq with these severe respiratory problems caused by those burn pits. The VA was really reluctant to cover that, and the PACT Act makes it clear that has to be covered. We've got a bunch of other legislation, some of which I'm the sponsor of, the rest of which I've co-sponsored, to try and enhance our benefits and our social safety net for veterans, because any time that you see a statistic that shows a veteran being homeless, for example, you know, that just breaks your heart. That should not be the case for these people that have served our country. And then lastly, I'm deeply engaged in this issue of enhancing care for our veterans within my district. The VA Loma Linda is a great facility, but has had some recent problems with its workforce and whistleblowers coming forward to allege hostile work environments. So I'm leading the effort to make sure that we enhance accountability there, because our veterans deserve the very best, and we can't give them the best if people aren't incentivized to work at facilities like Loma Linda. So lots going on, but really honored to be leading that effort.
All right, final minute to final thoughts.
Well, I want to thank everyone for your civic engagement. We've got elections coming up. Obviously, we've got a primary coming up in California at the beginning of March. We've got our general election coming up in November. I want to urge everyone who's listening, please, it is all of our civic responsibility to vote. It doesn't take a long time. It doesn't take a lot of effort. Cast an informed vote. Don't be one of these people that, you know, that makes an excuse for not voting. It's all of our responsibility. Get your ballot in. Get it in early to make sure it gets done. But let's all get out there to the polls and make sure our voices get heard.
How can people follow you?
Yep, Jay Obernolte, at jayobernolte.com. You just go on Google or whatever your search engine is, and it'll help you with the spelling. But you can subscribe to my newsletter. We're on every social media, anything that you're on, we're on. So please give me a follow, and we'll look forward to talking with you and supporting you in the future.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Absolutely. Thanks. Always enjoy it.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Voters on the March 5th ballot, which, by the way, has been sent out to everybody, I've got my ballot book in front of me, are going to be asked to authorize $6.38 billion in bonds to build mental health treatment facilities for those with mental health and substance use challenges. Provides housing for the homeless, legislative statute. You read it down here, and it says supporters, California Professional Firefighters, California Association of Veteran Service Agencies, opponents, Mental Health America of California, Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association. That's our good friend John Kupal over there, who I just happened to get on the phone, who's the president of the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, to help us understand what we're looking at here. Thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Larry, it's a pleasure. It is a $6.38 billion bond, and there quite a few of the mental health advocates are opposed to it for their own reasons. We're opposed for slightly different reasons, but they have a legitimate issue, and that is it diverts a substantial portion of the Prop 63 money, which was the million. Remember the millionaires tax is a 1% on millionaires that was supported by Daryl Steinberg, and it diverts that for other purposes, for things like shelter and stuff like that. Okay, let's step back a moment, Larry. Let's just step back and look at this thing. First of all, it's a bond. The question is this an appropriate use of bond financing? What people need to understand whenever they see the word bond, remember, bonds are not free money. This is borrowed money that we or our children are going to have to repay at some point down the line. And remember, when you borrow money, you have to pay interest on it. Now, the interest rates are coming down a little bit, but they're still significantly higher than they were just a couple of years ago. So there's interest costs. But more importantly, the constitutional requirement for bond financing is that it be used for capital improvements, a single work or project. That's what the Constitution says. And what the legislative analyst said about this bond proposal is that it hasn't identified the specific projects, So it's just kind of this kind of amorphous thing. We're going to build housing for the homeless. Here's the reality. Even at $6.38 billion, it won't even take care of 10% of the housing needs of the homeless population. So what have we seen? And you're in Los Angeles, Larry. What have we seen with these proposals that deal with homelessness issues? Whenever there's more money, they throw the money like gasoline onto a fire.
And it's gone.
California spends billions on this issue, and it's making the problem worse. And the very definition of insanity is keeping on doing what you have failed to work in the past and keep doing it. That's our number one issue.
Right. But I fear, just like, remember the Safe Schools and Neighborhoods Act? Anything that's going to help the homeless, everybody sees them around, they want to get them off the streets, they're going to say yes. I mean, voters in L.A. approve Measure H, Measure HH, whatever. And they keep doing this. Do we have any measurement on how this thing's doing? Is this going to pass, probably?
No, it might pass. Look, I'm a realist. A couple reasons. Number one, for the reason you just stated, that people recognize that there's an issue with homelessness and they want to do something about it. On the other hand, people who voted for H and HH are looking at that and going, "Didn't we just approve something?"
Yeah.
And why is the problem getting worse after we spend all this money? So that the fact that people have approved additional funds for homelessness issues in the past may not be a good indication about their continued willingness to do so. Mm. Number two, I think a lot of the whole issue of wrapping up housing and for the homeless without dealing with the root causes. None of this stuff is going to require diversion programs or sober living facilities. There's a huge resistance to requiring that anybody that goes into these publicly financed shelters must be in a diversionary program, must get off drugs, must get off alcohol, or be in a program to get them off. Without that, this is meaningless. This is meaningless. Now, can we talk for a moment, Larry, about the politics behind this?
Yes, because who's pushing this? Who wants this? Well, who's going to profit off this?
Okay, good question. First of all, the trades council, all the people who are going to build this stuff, it's all going to be used union labor, so it's going to be more expensive than it needs to be because they're going to use prevailing wage. And so the most effective homelessness programs out there, whether it's for shelters or programs, are done by faith-based organizations that don't take any government money. They actually improve the situation. This is not going to private organizations. This is going to be another publicly funded boondog. That's number one. Number two, the governor has fully committed his political capital behind Proposition 1. And the reason is, I believe, and maybe this is merely because I believe in conspiracy theories. I mean, some people call them conspiracy theories. I call them spoiler alerts.
Wait. Get out your tin hat, right? Tinfoil.
I got to get my tinfoil hat. Okay. The reality is, Gavin really has his eyes on national office.
Oh, yeah.
But he is extremely vulnerable on the homelessness issue. If you go back.
And crime.
If you go back and look at his quotes when he was mayor of San Francisco, how he was going to take care of the homelessness issue in San Francisco in a matter of 5 years or whatever it was. And of course the problem, he didn't. So I think what this is he is looking for political cover so he can say he's doing something about homelessness. And how much, why is this so important to him? A reflection of how important it is to him that he demanded quietly that the legislature not put any other competing measure on the ballot in March. So this is the only thing that people will be voting on because he did not want anything else to clutter up the ballot so everybody could focus on this. I mean, this is how important it is to him because I don't think he's concerned at all about the issue, but his primary concern is his own political career, and he knows that he is extremely vulnerable on the homelessness issue.
All right, talk to some people in government, and people I wouldn't think would be for this. One of them apparently is, and it was that part that you mentioned earlier, that it redirects funds already, and the argument that individual had was, it's redirecting something that already was passed. That is better than starting something new and putting it on top. And I'm like, yeah, but it's still, like you mentioned, indebtedness that has to be paid back. So, right?
Yeah. If this were merely reallocating Prop 63 revenue, you can do that without a bond measure. You could do that with a you could do that with a ballot measure, because Prop 63 was voted on by the voters. But what you could do is you could put something before the voters that says, take 10% of the Prop 63 money and direct it to this program. You could do that without a bond measure. That's the question I would have. This is not merely redirecting it. This is generating a whole lot of more public revenue that will have to be paid back by taxpayers.
Well, you mentioned the interest in, I don't know if it's three times or whatever it is, but if you
have... It's usually double. Yeah, okay. Usually double.
So $1 is $2 borrowed and has to be paid back. Right. I guess it's an opportunity for people who want to buy bonds, get some interest.
I mean, look, there are some of... I don't like indebtedness, but if you're a Californian who is upper middle class, double tax exempt bonds in the California municipal bond market, that's a good investment to be able to avoid both federal and state taxes. I won't say anything about my own portfolio, but I'll tell you, it's not a bad option.
Yeah.
It's not, it doesn't pay very much.
All right.
But it is tax free.
So no on this number one, this proposition one, the only one on there. Real quick, a lot of rumblings about a wealth tax. Not that it's going to affect me. Maybe you. You make the big money.
Not me.
The governor said, not under my watch, but there is a $68 billion or $37 billion. He got up and announced, it's not $68 billion, it's $37 billion hole. You know, he's got to plug that somehow between now and June, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're just going to have to curtail spending because he does not.
Spending?
I mean, that's what they should have been doing. That's what they should have been doing a long time ago. So a lot of this stuff, like expanding Medi-Cal for all undocumented individuals, that's going to have to be cut back. Yeah.
So how do you have a conversation with your friends so they don't say you're racist here? Because you're not trying to hurt people. But, the deal with that is that there are some people who are illegal who are going to get better health care than those who are legal in this country now.
That's exactly right. Well, a lot of it, some of the housing programs, too, in New York City, I mean, our veterans are still on the street, and yet they're providing housing for undocumented individuals.
How do you do that? How do you do that with a straight face?
I'll tell you, Larry, the African-American community in New York City is not happy with that at all, because remember when they actually moved undocumented individuals into a public school and threw out the African American school kids so that the undocumented aliens could have a place to stay? The African American parents
are
ballistic, as well they should. So look, there's a lot of progressive policies that are so bad, it's actually providing a political opportunity for conservatives.
Right.
Just saying, you guys are nuts.
But we should remind everyone, you are speaking on behalf of an organization that has both Democrats and Republicans who don't want their wallets to be picked, right? I mean,
a third of our members at the Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association are Democrats. They tend to be homeowners and productive individuals and Their number one fear is being taxed out of their home.
Right.
That's our typical membership.
All right. Got to tell you, Howard Jarvis Taxpayer Association, if you want to find out more about them, you can go to their website. Share it with us.
HJTA.org. That's HJTA.org. And 2024 is going to be a make or break year for the California taxpayers. It's either going to slide into the sea or we're going to be able to start repairing California to what it once was.
Howard Jarvis, Taxpayers Association, John Kupal with us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Larry. Take care.
And that's it for this week's program. See you next week.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.